And there is a most important cosmological paradigm which describes geometry of the universe and its constituencies. And the amazing fact is that if we trace its evolution to the beginning, backwards in time, it's a very dense universe where theoretical physics operates. And therefore, physics of very early universe is treated with theoretical physics. And our understanding of very early universe was evolving enormously in last 30 years, every decade, basically. And the present-day understanding, modern understanding, is associated with inflation, plus minus several years. And this paradigm of very early universe with inflation at the beginning is a good piece of theoretical physics. And it was developing since that time in parallel with supergravity, for instance, or string theory. So those things were going in parallel, time by time, talking to each other. And what I will try to present in today's lecture is a picture, theoretical picture, picture from perspective of theoretical physics, of very early universe with inflation. The first thing is to pick up a model of geometry. And the modern picture, the model of geometry, is based on perturbed Friedman cosmological model, which I will write down in the following form. And of course, we believe in string theory, and therefore, there is another piece which is associated with the six dimensions, and potentially they are warping in here and in here. And today we will discuss only four-dimensional piece, and I may talk a little bit about the rest of the universe. A is a scalar factor, tau is conformal time, and this portion is our four-dimensional portion written in conformal time. And this is perturbation of the metric. And the background geometry is, of course, homogeneous and uniform, described by only one function. And it's very convenient in cosmology to use conformal time. Conformal time is related to physical time. So I can rewrite unperturbed part of the metric in this form, and conformal time tau is related to physical time through this relationship. So why conformal time is very convenient? Because when we're talking about propagation of light or gravitons, conformal part is irrelevant, and we have to null only this portion, which evolves conformal time. And when we are calculating things like horizons, the conformal time appears. So it's very convenient. It's also technically very convenient because many things are simplified enormously. The picture of this geometry is represented by this plot. We have some time slices. This is three-dimensional space, time t, and this is the time slices. And free-falling particles are moving along the geodesics, and the distance between them is increasing as a scalar factor. Physical distance is the moving distance multiplied by the scalar factor, and everything is fine. we have dynamical equations which includes contribution from all components of matter, including cosmological term. And this is 0-0 Einstein equations. 0-0 Einstein equation has the character of the constraint equation. It has only first derivative of the scalar factor. In a sense, this is equivalent to the energy constraint. And second order dynamical equation is this one. And it includes trace of all components. Epsilon is energy density, P is the pressure, and this is equation for the trace. So this is 0-0 component, and this is mu-mu component, the trace of the Einstein equations. Everything in cosmology is defined by equation of state, and the very fact we're so successfully doing theory of large-scale structure and other things, even if we don't know microscopical origin of matter in the universe, is based on the fact that to do gravity, and cosmology is a very big system when only gravity operates, we need to know only equation of state. And equation of state is the relationship between pressure and energy density. They are two components of the energy momentum tensor, and we assume, as in most cases, that we are dealing with, we can treat particles, looking at the big volume, we can treat the plasma of particles as fluid. And this is isotropic fluid, which is characterized by isotropic pressure, and there is no shared components of the tensor. Usually there are very small corrections, like in case of neutrinos. I'm using multimedia, right? I'm using everything. So this is a great success of cosmology, this picture. It's a distribution of matter, which is able to cluster in the universe at the scale of 200 megaparsecs. And this is a theoretical model based on n-body simulations. And what you're supposed to see there, the contours of particles, more particles in filamentary-like, web-like pattern, less particles there, in the voids in between them. And we don't need to know the nature of those particles to do cosmology. So they represent cold dark matter particles. And we don't know what cold dark matter particles are. And we don't need to know to do cosmology. Because here we are dealing with enormously large scales. And the galaxy will be just a point over there. And to do this type of cosmology, we only need to specify that for cold dark matter, pressure is equal to zero. And therefore, we can operate with gravity, with the fluid of particles without pressure, and this is how it works. So this is why cosmological predictions are so robust. We only need to specify equation of state and follow up evolution throughout the full history. Just, this is just illustration. Okay, so in what are imaginable equation of, where is this high-tech thing to erase things? All right, good, thanks. So we know that there is a material component, and a material component is diluting as the universe expands as a cube of the scalar factor. This is just because the volume is increasing as the cube of the scalar factor and number of particles is the same. And pressure for this component is equal to zero. There is another component we know for sure in the universe is radiation. And radiation is diluting as the universe expanding as a to the minus four. This is because the number of photons, the density of photons, is diluting as the universe expands, but their energy, which is proportional to the frequency, is redshifting, inversely proportional to the scalar factor. And therefore, redshifting of energy density of photons has extra factor 1 over a relatively to matter. And radiation has pressure, and it goes like that. And let's play with only two of those components, matter and radiation, substitute in those two equations in this equation. So this is enough to have this equation. And pressure has zero energy momentum, trace of the energy momentum tensor. Only matter will contribute over here. And this second order equation now, I will rewrite using conformal time. So I'm using conformal time. And instead of the time derivatives d dt, I'm using conformal time, which is 1 over a d d tau. And if we play with the derivatives, this equation became a very simple equation. It will be just a prime prime is equal 4 pi g energy density of matter at the initial moment. Very simple equation. This is by way using conformal time. And solution of this equation is absolutely trivial. So solution of this equation is some initial value, tau, tau naught plus tau. This is it. We got the solution. And when tau much smaller than tau naught, this term dominates. Scalar factor goes like conformal time. And on the other hand, time is d tau a of tau, goes like a square of tau. And therefore, for radiation, scalar factor goes like square root of time. On the other hand, for situation when time is much more than tau naught, this term dominates. So scalar factor goes like tau squared. Time from this formula goes like tau cubed. And scalar factor goes like time and power 2/3, right? The rate of expansion is different at different stages. The overall picture is the following. The overall picture is that if this is time and this is a scalar factor, the universe expanding initially as square root of time and later as time in power 2/3. And this moment of time, time equilibrium, which corresponds to the moment when contribution of both energies, matter and radiation, are equal. And another interesting plot is we can substitute the scalar factor in here, and we find that the matter component goes like this one, while radiation goes like this one. It's diluted much faster. And before the equilibrium time, radiation dominates in the universe. And after equilibrium time, matter radiates in the universe. We need radiation in the universe. And the moment when photons became transparent and can come and to us as a cosmic microwave background radiation brings a lot of information, occurs slightly later than the time of equilibrium. In cosmology, we measure things in redshifts. And the moment of last scattering, when the light is coming to us, it corresponds to redshift about 1100. And the equilibrium moment corresponds to 10 to the 4. So this is 10 to the 3, this is 10 to the 4. It's very close. So just a little bit before, a few e-folding before radiation became transparent, radiation in the universe ceased to dominate and matter started to dominate. Such important things as a nucleosynthesis in the universe and biogenesis in the universe, they took place in very early stages, long before equilibrium takes place. So it's absolutely vital that in very early universe, radiation dominated. Otherwise, we wouldn't have successful nucleosynthesis. And if you will do string cosmology, and you will find that in your model, there are heavy relics which behave like matter particles, which have equation of state of this type. It's very bad, because if you have a lot of those relics, they can start to dominate much earlier, because radiation diluted is too fast, and move this epoch of equilibrium before nucleosynthesis. We don't need this. We need to save it. And this is pretty important tests. So we don't want to have too many heavy, massive particles from string theory, like the Kalutzic line excitations. We also know from nucleosynthesis, I'm not going to talk about nucleosynthesis. Hopefully it was covered. I'm just reminding you from very simple picture already, many conclusions can be drawn. If we know pretty well the conditions to have nucleosynthesis, and they are for sure photons at this moment, which behave as relativistic particles, and they are three type of neutrinos. And there is a little bit room, maybe a few percent, to have other relic relativistic species at the time, like gravitons, for instance. But if there is too much gravitons, it will spoil nucleosynthesis. The universe will expand here much faster, a little bit faster. Numerical coefficients will be different, and nucleosynthesis will be spoiled. And if you do, again, string cosmology, and somehow you produce too many gravitons, and gravitons interact, don't interact, they freely propagate as the universe expands, but they contribute to radiation energy density, to here. And those gravitons will spoil nucleosynthesis. And it's very easy to overproduce gravitons in string theory. When string inflation ends by brain anti-brain annihilation, there may be one of the products of this annihilation, which is easy to produce, will be light massless gravitons. And it's not very good. You have to take care of this. So because those gravitons will spoil nucleosynthesis. Right. And all of this is based on very, very basic picture, like what I'm talking about. One more component, which we think is with us, and this is cosmological constant. So we think that there is potentially another equation of state, P lambda is approximately minus epsilon lambda. And if you have this equation of state dominates in the universe, it's better to substitute in the first equation, because it will be the first order equation. This is constant. A dot over A is trivially to solve. The scalar factor of the universe is A in power ht, exponentially expanding. And in conformal time, so exponentially expanding from minus infinity to plus infinity, if I have only this in the universe. And if I go to conformal time, it has the following form, h minus tau, but tau is changing from minus infinity to zero. Right, so the scalar factor is again increasing. very fast, and we know that inflation will respond to this stage. So this stage goes first, then radiation, then matter domination. And again, late time inflation today. This is full evolution. But the purpose was to just remind you the background geometry. Okay. It's this interaction can lead only to one thing, that you, if it's a thermal equilibrium, it doesn't change the number of particles. If you have the plasma, which is expanding, and there is a thermal equilibrium, which is, there is thermal equilibrium, then whatever is massive stays massive. If it would decay, it decay much earlier. So in the thermal equilibrium, everything is fixed. In the thermal equilibrium, ratio between massive component and massless component, or whatever light component, is fixed. If we have some time, it's a good question, because it prompted me to tell about something else. When most of the evolution of the universe is pretty boring. It's just thermal equilibrium. The most interesting epochs why we can, in principle, observe things and why things like nucleosynthesis happens or baryogenesis, they are due to the very short and very few periods when the universe is out of equilibrium. When the universe is temporarily out of equilibrium, then the so-called freezing out things happens. The out of equilibrium phenomena can give you some non-trivial residuals, which otherwise wouldn't be presented. As I said, for instance, photons, relic photons, they are nothing but such relics, because there was a period over here of recombination, and plasma of electron and protons became transparent for photons, and they were able to propagate freely without interactions. But before this moment, there was thermal equilibrium, and photons were trapped. So the answer to your question is there are 1, 2, 3, 4 very short periods, the most interesting, because they give us the remnants which we observed. Okay, this is more or less very well known and very simple story. More evolved story is related to global geometry, to horizons. And what I'm going to do now, I will remind you about horizons we're using in cosmology. And the horizons are very important when we talk about global structure of the universe, the De Sitter in very early universe, or today's De Sitter, ideas of holography, and ideas on initial conditions. We need to know the global geometry. To embed cosmology into the string theory, we need to know global geometry. There are different horizons. And before I will do horizons, I just remind you the picture, which you probably already seen or seen many times in textbooks. And this is the following picture. The horizons often is drawn as 1 over h, 1 over Hubble parameter. And the Hubble parameter is defined as a dot over a. And for radiation or matter dominated universe, a is t in some power alpha, 1/2 of 2/3, as just we discussed. Make this derivation. You will get 1 over t. The Hubble parameter is 1 over t. an inverse Hubble is proportional to time t. So it's kind of corresponds to the feeling that light is just propagating. And this is what we can see. And for the Friedman universe, this is how the horizon looks like. For De Sitter universe, inflationary universe, A dot over A is constant. It stays like that. This is what people are drawing, right? It's kind of Hubble length evolving with time. And there is another very important thing in cosmology, redshifting of fluctuations and redshifting of any waves. Let me remind you how waves behave in expanding universe, because all experiments are based on detection of photons, which are redshifting. If I have a photon emitted with wavelengths, I'm the knot at the moment when scalar factor was this one, a t naught, then later on it will be detected with the wavelength, which is larger because of the expansion of the universe, and this wavelength is proportional to the scalar factor. So in other words, literally, the wavelength of the photon is stretched as uniform is expanding. So do I need to derive this formula, or it's very well known? Is there any, everyone knows this formula? So the derivation goes like that. So imagine I have two observers, and I send nearby observers, and my photon with the wavelengths lambda naught was sent and detected by another observer over here. And this photon was sent at moment t, and this was sent at the moment t plus delta t. And because the universe is expanding, they're moving apart from each other, those two observers, and the if you stop by the policeman, you always can say that the red light was redshifted, and I didn't see it because of the velocity. There's a Doppler formula which connects the wavelengths and the emitter multiplied by the Doppler factor. V is the velocity, relative velocity, right? And in expanding universe, the whole definition of expansion is such that velocity between two points in expanding universe are expanding proportional to the Hubble parameter, to the derivative of the scalar factor divided by the scalar factor itself, multiplying by the distance between objects. So the more removed galaxies, the faster they are moving from us, right? This is what happens if I have, if I take a balloon, blow it up, that the points which are further from each other will be expanding faster, and the coefficient of proportionality will be the same for the whole balloon, right? Because of the scaling, if you wish, it's the scaling. So substitute this velocity over here. I also noticed that for nearby delta L is just h delta t. The distance is proportional to time. So substituted here will be lambda t, 1 plus h delta t, OK? So on the other hand, independently, what I have observed here, I decomposed into Taylor expansion. It will be lambda dot delta t, or it will be lambda 1 plus lambda dot over lambda delta t. So now I have to equalize this formula in that formula, and I obtain lambda dot over lambda is Hubble parameter, and Hubble parameter is a over a. And I have a very complicated equation. I solve this equation, and this is the solution of the equation, right? So we have a redshift. All the waves are redshifting with a scalar factor. This is enormously important effect in cosmology, absolutely enormously important effect in cosmology. And it's related not only to the waves of electromagnetic radiation, it's important for all waves. I'm speaking now, and if I talk very loudly to the cosmos, my voice will be redshifted too. And it goes like that. I have any physical thing which are time-dependent and x-dependent, and I do, if this thing is a small ripples of something, I do Fourier decomposition of these small ripples. And my Fourier decomposition in an expanding homogeneous universe can be decomposed in Fourier series, and I have to use co-moving wavelengths here. And the lambda, the physical wavelengths, is 2 pi over k. K is a co-moving momentum which is not changing with time. It's the frequency of my voice here at the moment of emission multiplied by scalar factor. All the waves are redshifted in the universe. And one of the most important waves in the universe are fluctuations. So ripples of the space and time. They include scalar fluctuations. They include gravitational waves, whatever fluctuations we're considering. They also can be decomposed in Fourier modes. And their wavelengths are redshifting. And at this diagram, it means that for this inverse Hubble parameter goes like time t, and the wavelengths, they're going like scalar factor. And the scalar factor is goes either like square root of time or two-thirds of the radiation, the matter dominated. So this growth of scalar factor is much slower than the inverse size of the horizon. And if we start with the fluctuations, which are bigger than the size of the horizon, as time goes, they sooner or later will enter the horizon. And we will see them. They will perturb our the matter, et cetera, et cetera. They're responsible for inhomogeneities which generate this picture. So this picture, view graph, shows nonlinear distribution of matter, but this nonlinear distribution came from linear fluctuations. And linear fluctuations, if we trace them back, they were outside of the horizon in the very, very, very early universe. During inflation, the scalar factor is exponentially expanding. And therefore, my fluctuations actually were inside this horizon. And this is what you see in the textbooks, that fluctuations generating from inflation, they sent outside away and then enter again. You've seen this picture in textbooks, right, or somewhere else? So this picture is crap. So this picture has only heuristic meaning because we have to define what we're talking about, what is the horizon. And it has only heuristic meaning which shows relative scales. And when we're doing theoretical physics with cosmology, inverse Hubble length has only heuristic meaning. So we have to turn to Boring definition of the horizons and see what happens. There are three different, in use, there's three different concepts of horizon. And most useful is the particle horizon. The particle horizon is the closest one to this physical picture. And it defines it like follows. So imagine space-time. This is time. this initial hypersurface. And I have observer over here, and there is a light cone in the past. So, and this is the region which is in causal contact with my observer at the event all over here. And imagine the geodesics of particles from here. And this is the particle horizon. This is the particle horizon. So those particles cannot be seen by my observer today. And particles inside this horizon, they can be seen. So it can be defined as physical distance traveled by light. And this physical distance is easy to calculate. I told you that we have to jump to conformal coordinates because in conformal coordinates, the metric is this one. And light is traveling such way that interval is equal to zero. So we have to nullify this portion only. And therefore, commoving distance covered by light traveling within the interval delta tau corresponds to the interval in conformal time and go back to dt over a of t prime prime t. Okay? The physical distance, delta r, is scalar factor multiplied by delta x. And if we combine it together, so we have expression for the particle horizon, which is t a of t dt a of t. And it's basically a causally connected region in the past for us today, and it's intuitively well understood. Okay, let's play with our cosmology. So let's say that we don't have inflation. We start with Big Bang at zero over here. And we know detailed evolution of the scalar factor. We know the Hubble parameter, the expansion of the universe. We know constituencies, including cosmological constant, radiation, and matter. We know how much radiation and how much matter in the universe. And we can substitute this in that formula. And to get today the distance 1,460 megaparsecs. So megaparsec is 3.9 × 10^24 centimeter. Astronomers using megaparsecs. The size of this simulation is 200 megaparsecs. So you can see it's pretty big. It's maybe 1/10 of the what we expect to see in the universe, maybe smaller. I cannot divide 100s. Right, and the physical meaning of this distance is when we have a moment of recombination, this is how far we can see, and the moment of recombination is very, very close to zero, relatively to the 14 billion years, the age of the universe. So most contribution to the integral came in the latest time. Okay, let's take now inflation, De Sitter stage, just De Sitter stage over here, little one. And for De Sitter stage, we substitute exponent here and here, and we start from some moment T naught, and what we get is that the particle horizon is increasing with time like that. So, and if we have a very, very long inflation, particle horizon blows up. So for inflationary universe, particle horizon is exponentially increasing. For De Sitter, for Friedman universe, with matter radiation, it's finite alone. So of course, in reality, what we have to do, we have to take here the moment when inflation begins and take scalar factors, the whole history of the scalar factor, and we'll get very big particle horizon, right? It means that when we go very to the very, very beginning of things, even before inflation, our particle horizon will be very big. And this is exactly why inhomogeneities are capable to be in causal contact with us, because there was a long story before us. There is, of course, particle horizon is increasing with time. The picture for the particle horizon goes like that. This is time, this is us, and we are moving further, and as time goes, this causally connected region in the past, this one, is increasing, increasing, increasing with time, right? So this is the meaning of the particle horizon. So RH is a function of T. So when we say the observable universe has this horizon, it's true in a certain sense. It's in a sense that if we started from Big Bang, we'll see as much. But it's almost correct and enough to do physics, because we are interested in how much photons were traveling. And photons were traveling only from the last scattering surface. Okay, what about other definition of horizons? There is event horizon. The event horizon is a part of the universe from which we can ever, up to some time, receive information, up to maximal time in the future, receive information about events today. The event horizon is defined very much similar to particle horizon. The only difference is this integral has different meanings. The limits of this integration are different. In De Sitter, in pure De Sitter cosmology, this integral, even T max formally is infinity, this is converged and equal to 1 over h. So event horizon of De Sitter geometry alone is 1 over h. But event horizon has no meaning for the Friedman universe. In a few minutes, I will jump to the Penrose diagrams and will show you how event horizon look like. And the only message here for you to say that the event horizon is well defined for De Sitter universe. And event horizon is meaningless for the Friedman universe. And because our universe will become De Sitter again, when cosmological constant will work, the event horizon is not fully defined concept, it's a good concept. However, this picture plots event horizon for De Sitter and particle horizon for Friedman universe, therefore just ill-defined picture. But heuristically, it's okay. So my message is bad. Theoretical physics. There is another interesting horizon. So event horizon, if you have your space-time with the beginning and with the end, and this is maximal time, so this is what you can see. And for some manifold, it's defined. For some manifold, it's not defined. There is another interesting horizon, which is called apparent horizon. And apparent horizon is related to trapped surfaces. And when people are talking about holography, the holography is associated with information, the two-dimensional apparent horizon. The apparent horizon is defined in the following way. If I have light in my spacetime t in x, it's very convenient to draw light cones. And this is my observer. It may happen that the light cones is oriented towards observer in such a way that light is not going to my direction if light cone is too far away from me. So the typical situation is nearby, I have light in one of the direction is good, so I can send light outside, but I can sight inside. On the other hand, if geometry is too much curved or something happens with geometry, I cannot in principle send light to me. It always will be swept away by dynamics. And the bordering case, when I have the light cone, this bordering case corresponds to superposition of the light cones, and this distance corresponds to apparent horizon. For De Sitter universe, in the Friedman universe, for cosmological solutions, there are always apparent horizon. And one can get a feeling what is going on for De Sitter universe. So imagine you have slices of De Sitter universe, which corresponds to Friedman cosmology. And the expansion between two points is proportional to the distance between them. And if my distance, Hubble's constant, is larger than h, my expansion for those distances is faster than speed of light. I have a superluminal expansion. It means that, imagine I'm in the De Sitter universe, and I surrounded myself by light flashes. And if they're nearby, the distance smaller than inverse h, then the expansion of the universe is still slowing down, redshifting the light, from those light flashes. But if they are too far away, expansion swept away electromagnetic waves and does not allow them to go to me. So I always have a situation like light cone turned away. For De Sitter universe, apparent horizon is the same as the event horizon. And for Friedman universe, for matter-dominated Friedman universe, apparent horizon goes like one third of time, very different from particle horizon. It's very different thing. There are formulas to calculate apparent horizon, and if you manage to rewrite your metric in spherically symmetric form, you have a radial coordinate, and the condition that your covariant derivative of the radial coordinate is equal to this combination, this vector is equal to zero, is the operational formula to calculate apparent horizon. Okay, now we will show you Penrose diagrams technique, and we will see how those different horizons pop up in the Penrose diagram. Right, so to talk about global geometry, we need a method to describe a very big thing in compact form. And we want to describe different geometries to embrace the beginning and the end, all of those, and to see causal structures altogether. This technique is known as the Penrose diagrams, Carter-Penrose diagram. Let me begin with the Minkowski spacetime first. And the Minkowski spacetime can be rewritten in spherically symmetric coordinates. This is two-dimensional sphere. And if I plot this in terms of time and in terms of radius, this is what I'll get. Right. It's just r coordinate, and this is time coordinate, and infinity is there, and fast infinity is there. And light is going like that. This is trajectory of the light. Light cones will be 45 degrees tilted relatively to this net. And I cannot see infinities. How we can see infinities? For this, we forget about two-dimensional spherical components and concentrate on two-dimensional T and R components. And for string theorists, it is a very familiar thing to jump to conformal transformation with those variables. Just a mathematical game. I'm playing with different coordinates, and dt square minus dr square metric can be rewritten as f prime g prime dt prime square minus dr prime square. So this transformation guarantees conformal transformation of the metric. This is exactly what is done on the world sheet. And now we will try to find functions f and g to make the region of t prime and r prime finite. And if you take, you can do whatever you want. You have probably different choices. Tan t prime plus r prime over 2, and tan t prime minus r prime over 2. If you do this, then the metric will give us some expression. And we don't care about this expression much, because if we're interested in the light trajectories, then it's all defined by zero of this expression. And this type of transformation guarantees that in new coordinates, light, again, will be propagating along the 45 degrees inclined lines. And the choice of the tan functions tells us that the whole space-time, which runs from minus infinity to infinity and from 0 to infinity, can be very nicely mapped into the finite romb with the new coordinates. This is a time coordinate here. This is a radial coordinate here. There are infinities. And for these coordinates, minus pi goes pi and minus pi for t minus pi. So the range of new coordinates, t prime and r prime, I define by these conditions now. If I have some physical regions, which is this shape over here, here it will be differently shaped. The Penrose diagram is not science, it's an art. What you do with this, I can multiply this by arbitrary scalar factor, which is arbitrarily depends on new coordinates, and it will be doing local scaling with my region, and I can make a nice elephant here, right? But it still will be Penrose diagram, and still will be guaranteed that the light cones will be like that. And it's still guaranteed that infinities will be fixed by intrinsic properties. So the message is that you can rescale locally everything within Penrose diagram by further conformal transformation, which some way depend non-linearly on your coordinates. The only thing important is that this one and the borders in those terms, they are untouchable by conformal transformations. This is why to draw Penrose diagram is to draw the borders. So Minkowski spacetime was a trivial example. Now we go to do cosmology. And let's warm up with the simple examples. De Sitter geometry. The De Sitter geometry was considered in numerous papers on string theory in De Sitter spacetime. It's plotted here. Right, so what is here? The De Sitter geometry, the whole manifold which describes this, can be embedded in five-dimensional space-time. If I have five-dimensional space-time with the coordinates dv square plus dw square plus dx square plus dy square plus dz square, and I take hyperboloid minus v square plus wv square plus x square plus y square plus z square is equal to 1 over h square, then this hyperboloid, which is depicted in this picture, is the full De Sitter manifold, which describes the universe in one slices, which describes static universe, the static solution in another slices, and they are very, very different slices. There is, it's absolutely beautiful space-time. If I rotate one of the coordinates of this space-time very embedded, auxiliary space-time, I make it sphere, and it will be nothing but S5 sphere. Because I made weak rotation from one coordinate, the group of this space-time is S1,4. It has a lot of symmetry. There are different coordinates possible to choose. And the coordinates at De Sitter four-dimensional, this is five-dimensional piece, as the four-dimensional space-time is dt square minus 1 over h square cos ht, it's cos hyperbolicus, multiplied by d chi square plus sine square chi square d theta square plus sine square theta d phi square. So this is S2 metric. This is S3 metric. And if I take recortation for time, it will be S4 metric, four-dimensional, so it's a four-dimensional sphere. Right. This form of the metric describes expanding universe. It has a perfectly form, which we're using in cosmology, with a positively curved space-time. But the scalar factor for this universe is initially shrinking and then expanding. In cosmology, we are using different slicing of De Sitter space-time. I can make coordinate transformation and jump to so-called a planar slicing. A planar slicing is dt squared minus e in power ht dx squared. It's three-dimensional flat space-time. Very simple. And Penrose diagram, which corresponds to full De Sitter, is given by this square. Can you see it? Good, thanks. This is what happens if I take my metric and do coordinate transformation and forget about conformal factor, and what left will have this causal structure. It has no singularity. It starts from minus infinity to infinity. Each point here corresponds to two-dimensional sphere. Edge of this diagram corresponds to pole of the three-dimensional sphere. And everything is occurring over here. Different slicing will give us different patches of De Sitter geometry. This one, upper one, covered by this triangle, corresponds to planar slicing. This is what we used in cosmology. And it covers only half of De Sitter space-time. If I put my observer at the middle, I will see the horizon. This is event horizon. And the apparent horizon too. Because you see this light cone. This light cone exactly divides causally connected and causally disconnected region from my observer. The slices of constant time corresponds to those curves, and slices of constant coordinates corresponds to those curves. And they are physical coordinates. And when I was drawing the picture that the wavelengths are redshifting and go outside of the horizon, it exactly happens if I have a wave, and as we go, it's redshifting, 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 and at some moment goes outside of the horizon. So each point of this diagram, as I said, is S2 sphere. And if I take this line, the horizon, S2 sphere, at each point of this line has the same radius, 1 over h, and it's constant for De Sitter geometry. There is another slicing which corresponds to static patch. Again, playing with the coordinates, I can rewrite this geometry in the form similar to Schwarzschild geometry. So there are explicit analytical mapping between this form of metric, that form of metric, and that form of metric. They all describe the same space-time, but at different coordinates in different patches of the whole geometry. So this is what static patch occupies. Now my observer here sees this horizon, and the time is running from minus infinity to plus infinity here, and it sees the horizon, and it looks like he is in a cave, and there is a horizon over there. And this picture is very inspirative. It's kind of very similar to black hole situation, but inverse to it. So when we are outside of black hole and see the horizon, we know where the horizon is. Here, we are sitting inside the object, inside the radius. 1 over h is the radius when this turns to zero, and it corresponds to the horizon. There is a redshift effect. If things are shifted nearby horizon to us, they will be enormously redshifted, et cetera, et cetera. So they're all the same space-time, effective space-time. However, if we start to do physics, quantum field theory especially, the picture which we'll see in static patch and picture which we'll see in cosmological patch, let me put it this way, are very different. And there are two communities, cosmologists, which live in this patch, and many theoretical physicists and string theorists which are living in this patch. And there are effects found in cosmological patches which are hard to translate in terms of the observer within the cave. There should be, of course, common language, but it's not easy to do. And I will concentrate what cosmology see. Yes. Flat. Yes. It's possible to make transformation. Yeah. There is no mystery. It's possible to do transformation. Not for the sitter. The sitter has enormously high symmetry group. Not for the sitter. So for the sitter space time, you do. There are, I can show you explicit, as I said, if you take the Hawking helix elliptical structure of space time, there are explicit formulas showing this transition. They're pretty simple. Right. For Friedman universe, Penrose diagram is this one. The Penrose diagram for Friedman universe, take a half of the Minkowski space-time Penrose diagram, the causal structure of the future is the same, but time begins from singularity, and here is the singularity. And it's now an interesting exercise. What happens if our universe became asymptotically the sitter universe? In this case, Penrose diagram will be like that. It starts from singularity, but it should have the structure of a full de sitter geometry. Okay, the plan is now to tell you why we forced to change the Big Bang picture and to take inflation seriously from point of view of general relativity, only from point of view of general relativity. And after that, I want to talk about inflation based on the scalar field and tell you how scalar field enters the game. And we will have inflation with the scalar field, pretty generic case. This will be pretty generic consideration, including string inflation, etc. And I want to show how Penrose diagrams will look like in realistic cosmology, which has inflation in the past and Friedman stage now and de Sitter universe again. So we end up with a Penrose diagram, which looks like that. The endpoint will be Penrose diagram, which has singularity in the past and many Friedman domains in the future. And we're living in one of them. And there is a fractal, those universes, infinite number in between. And you may see this picture in the literature, but at the end, I will tell you that it's garbage. And the concept of Penrose diagram for the universe with inflation is ill-defined. And there is no intelligent answer how to describe global structure of the universe. We don't know it because we don't know quantum gravity. This is the plan. Okay, but let's build up the elements for this. I believe my friend Mark Trodden told you why inflation is good. And I believe he mostly concentrated on high energy physics arguments. But there are two very strong arguments which came from general relativity. So we discussed the Friedman homogeneous and isotropic metric. However, if I consider Einstein equations, with physically motivated equation of state like matter and radiation, then typical solution of those equations, cosmological solutions, which you describe cosmological solutions, not spherically symmetric, but solutions which are dealing with a big expanding space. I don't think there is a good definition of what we call cosmological solutions, right? Just expanding. And the typical solutions will be very, very, very different from Friedman uniform and homogeneous solutions. And if I consider different forms of the light fronts, the Friedman solution would correspond to a flower. Right? So the white wave front of the light in form of flower is has a measure zero, right? In the whole space of solutions. The typical solutions of the wave fronts are chaotic, et cetera, et cetera. Very same with the generic solution of the Einstein equations. They are anisotropic and they are inhomogeneous and they are very dynamical, and the Friedman solution has measure zero among all of those solutions. There is a simple exercise to play with. So imagine I have a big bang, and I have my solution in the form of Friedman solution. And let me have radiation So because scalar factor is proportional to square root of t, the square of the scalar factor is proportional to time, and this is the time. Now I'm saying, okay, I don't like homogeneous solution, right? Let's see if there are other solutions. And it's very hard to find generic solutions. However, around singularity, t is equal to zero, if I'm working with the convenient p is equal to 1/3 of epsilon or p is equal to zero equation of states, I can write down Einstein equations around singularity and decompose it with respect to the small time, t. The t nearby singularity, just do linearized analysis in respect with t. But my special coordinates, dependence on the special coordinates, not necessarily small. So in other words, I'm considering geometry, which may be very much rippled, right? So my space-time is very much rippled. This is time t, and this is space. And I'm considering this geometry around t is equal to zero, because I can do analysis analytically. And I write down my solution in the form t alpha ab plus t square beta, b alpha beta, etc. d x alpha, dx beta. Alpha and beta are running from 1 to 3 special coordinates. I always can choose this type of the coordinates when metric is equal, when the cross components between time and coordinates is equal to zero, it's called synchronous coordinate system. It always can be done. And I have this ansatz from the metric. I substitute to the Einstein equations, and I found that all the dynamics for matter and metrics is defined by three independent functions for metric A. There are three functions in this tensor which are fully defined for the dynamics, but otherwise they're absolutely arbitrary, right? It just shows that there are infinite number of inhomogeneous solutions which are describing inhomogeneous universe. And there should be very, very, very special conditions to make those three functions flat, independent on the coordinate. So it's a simple exercise to do, well, some elaborated Einstein equations. You can find it in Landau-Lifshitz classical field theory. Here we just state this fact. There is another class of solutions which is also very generic, anisotropic solutions. Anisotropic solutions are described, they again, cosmological solutions by metric with a three independent scalar factor, all of them time dependent. A, B, and C. Again, I can substitute them in the Einstein equations. And this is class of metric different from inhomogeneous metrics. It's anisotropic metrics. And it'll get famous Kasner solution. And Kasner solution gives power law dependence for A, B, and C. And we can try to combine anisotropic and inhomogeneous solutions, and we see even bigger class of solutions. So the bottom line is that without special reasons, our universe should be very anisotropic and inhomogeneous. It turns out that if we introduced effective cosmological constant, which is not necessarily a straight constant, but something which is acting within finite interval of time, then this isotropized, this cosmological constant, isotropized and homogenized the solution. So in other words, if in our Einstein equations, we also introduced effective cosmological constant, which is acting within certain time interval, then generic solution will be isotropic. It's initially maybe anisotropic, but cosmological constant makes it isotropic. And analysis is done very similarly how it was done here for small time t. However, technical non-triviality is that time t, we started from singularity because it has singularity. When we have effective cosmological constant, there is no singularity. And asymptotic form of solution in this case is slightly different, but bottom line is that the metric looks like this one. And other terms. So, and if you substitute this ansatz in the Einstein equations, you convince yourself that all further terms are dying out very quickly. And if we calculate anisotropy of this geometry, this anisotropy is dying very quickly. The anisotropy of four-dimensional geometry and any other geometry is characterized by the Weyl tensor. And anisotropy goes like e to the minus 6ht. So we need effective cosmological constant to make our space-time homogeneous. The inhomogeneities are stretched. About the Weyl tensor, in general relativity, I assume you familiar with general relativity, geometry is described by the Riemann tensor, and Riemann tensor can be constructed from its trace Ricci tensor and the Weyl tensor. And Ricci tensor enters Einstein equations, and the Weyl tensor is describing, in particular, a pure gravitational degrees of freedom. For instance, I was talking about the Kasner solution. The Kasner solution is a vacuum solution. So it corresponds to the solutions of the Einstein equations without the sources. But for the Kasner solution, anisotropy is very big. On the other hand, all cosmological solutions, all other conformally flat solutions, they correspond to vanishing Weyl tensor. And in our universe, Weyl tensor for the background solution is zero. So it's non-zero for fluctuations, but it's zero for us. And the point is, if we introduce effective cosmological constant, the Weyl tensor of initially anisotropic matrix is very quickly dying out. I'll give you an example, which we will explore a little bit later. How it works, how exactly effective cosmological constant makes geometry isotropic. The two-dimensional example of what, four-dimensional example of what often used in supergravity in the string theory. So let us consider space-time, which has two-dimensional de Sitter geometry. multiplied by two-dimensional sphere. So if I make a weak rotation, I'll have just sphere multiplied by sphere. If I do it back, Lorentzian section, I'll have two-dimensional de Sitter multiplied by ds2 by s2. And it's a prototype, it's a four-dimensional prototype of many models of computification like Ford Rubin, et cetera. How stable is this solution? So let us consider this is clearly an anisotropic solution. We can calculate this is an anisotropic solution. It has wild tensor, big wild tensor. And let us consider Einstein equations. With the effective cosmological constant. This is constant here. So what we do, yeah, clearly that this metric satisfies this solution because it has a symmetry, it's diagonal symmetry, and I choose radius here and radius here, such that the coefficients all tuned. Okay, let's consider now a class of the metrics for which this one is a particular solution. So we are trying to guess to which geometries this metric can evolve. And we suggest for dx squared. So for so-called two-dimensional part, we just take Friedman form. But for this part, we take also a scalar factor. It's a two-dimensional scalar factor. Moduli fields. A scalar factor are moduli fields. So a moduli field already appear in four-dimensional geometry. And the scalar factors behave like a moduli field. We substitute them in the Einstein equations. And one of the, after playing with the coefficients, we get second order equation. We can exclude A and A dot and play only with B. So this is the equation we end up. 2B dot dot over B plus B dot B square plus term associated with the curvature is equal to lambda. This is very similar to the equation, second order equation for lambda we had just at the beginning here. So there are also other equations. For instance, A dot over A is equal to B dot dot over B. So dot, after we calculate B, we can calculate A, and the whole system is fixed. So we can solve this equation. And let me introduce a technique which will be enormously useful when we'll talk about inflation. So this is second order differential equation which has no time t in their coefficients explicitly. This is typical for moduli fields too. And the way to solve second order equation is to use method of the phase portraits. This is enormously powerful method because it exhausted all the solutions. And as I said, when we'll discuss inflation, this method will help us a lot. So I'm using this occasion to introduce the method of the phase portraits. If we have a system of differential equations, dy dx is equal to q yx. Sorry, dy dt and dx dt is p yx. And those functions can be ugly nonlinear functions, like those pretty nonlinear functions. And time t is not entering in the right hand side. Then what we do, we looking for solution of this system, and we're finding all the pairs, x and y, and they are at critical points. And after that, we analyzing this system around the critical points, and we are plotting the phase portrait, the phase portrait for variables y and x. And around critical points, depending on its character, the curves may be like that, or the curves may be like that. This is called a saddle point. This is called a focus point, or it can be repulsion if it's at infinity. And then what we do, we know that this space of y and x, it's called the phase space of the system, is covered by trajectories, and trajectories are not intersecting. They never intersect. And therefore, you identify the critical points, and you easily can figure out how they can be connected to cover the whole plane with the trajectories. And you know the beginning and the end of trajectories without technical details. You know the qualitative picture completely. For this system, for instance, the phase space looks like this one. There is one saddle point, and there are separatrixes. And all the solutions are represented by curves, which are showing the flow, how it's developed with time. Are important. Right, so it shows that B dot and B, the trajectories, they started somewhere at infinity, going like that, further to infinity. They can go in this direction, in that directions. And you see that all the flows are bringing solutions either here or here or there. And each of the branches of solutions has a lot of physical sense. And in particular, this territory, it all goes to solution where asymptotically A of t is sine hyperbolicus h t, B of t is cosine hyperbolicus ht, and h is equal square root of a lambda over 3, and they are asymptotically equal to each other, and this space-time became De Sitter space-time, four-dimensional De Sitter space-time. This saddle point corresponds to this solution, sphere-to-sphere multiplied by sphere. It's unstable. It's unstable solution, and if you give small fluctuation around it, and take it and bring it over there. And the De Sitter solution has vanishing wild tensor. This solution has a big wild tensor. This is a particular example when we start with a very anisotropic solution and it evolves and gives De Sitter solution. This asymptotic corresponds to the Kasner solution. So not necessarily when we make those inhomogeneities, we go to De Sitter solution. We happily can go to contracting Kasner solution. So therefore, De Sitter solution is not a unique one, but it's a big one. In a sense, it's stable, and it's giving us good cosmology. So that was just an illustration of overall statement. If we have effective cosmological constant, it makes solution isotropic. Okay, scalar field. The scalar field is What makes effective cosmological constant? So now we are changing our cosmology. And we are saying that in very early universe, we have radiation operating at small times. We have matter operating today. But we are saying we need something at the beginning what gives initial conditions for our universe. And overall evolution is divided into a standard Big Bang picture, which had radiation and matter, and the stage before, which corresponds to inflation. So, and this is the hypersurface of time, where all the initial conditions came from inflation, and further inherited by Friedman stage with radiation and matter. So, this is a path described by physical cosmology in the old-fashioned sense. This is a path which has inflation. And inflation is where effective equation of state is vacuum-like equation of state. And for inflation, scalar factor is exponentially expanding. And De Sitter geometry, or quasi-De Sitter geometry, local quasi-De Sitter geometry takes place. And initial conditions will be such for the further evolution that the universe is homogeneous and isotropic. So how we can achieve this equation of state? And most economic and most natural way to do it in theoretical physics is to play with the scalar fields. For the scalar field, I see. I can stop and continue tomorrow. Right. So tomorrow I will continue with the scalar field and we will draw phase portraits for the scalar field and Penrose diagrams, and I'll tell you that it's garbage.
May I ask you a question? Можно, пожалуйста, the slice on the so what? So this was the horizon, right? This were constantine slices. And this were radial slices. So this is a horizon only for a particle for an observer on the boundary. Any observer which is defined.